Some of you may have seen the Rembrandt exhibit at the Philadelphia Art Museum, Faces of Jesus. If you haven't seen it, it's no longer there. I feel bad when I say that. I was going to say how great it was, and it's no longer there. So it's sort of like, if you didn't see it, well, tough luck. But it's one of those things that, like, when you say the well-known author, and then if you don't know it, well, how well-known? And then you feel like you haven't, you know, it's those things that are awful, awkward after you say them. But I was invited to go with some Episcopalian friends to a dialogue on Jesus in several faith traditions. There were Jewish representatives, Muslim representatives, and Christian representatives. And afterwards, a Christian guy who teaches at Duke and has dual appointments in the religion department and the art department did a talk on images of Jesus in culture. And he showed us a lot of interesting images, like, I mean, these are a couple of the sort of things he showed us. You have the buddy Jesus, right, the South Park Jesus, Asian Jesus, an African kind of Jesus, a kind of Eucharistic Jesus, the sort of Brazil. And you could go on and on and on and on, right? Jesus has this ability. He talked about Jesus just somehow, there's something about him that people want to connect with and make their own. He even showed us something that, like, people psychologically can look at a Rorschach test. You know, there's psychological tests when they say, like, you know, look at this, and you say, it looks like a cockroach, you know, mating or something, and you're like, oh, gosh, I'm crazy. But when they show this, they've shown a lot of people can identify this as Jesus. There's just something so familiar about him, and yet so mysterious. Right, so familiar, and yet so mysterious. I read a book in seminary that, like, captured my imagination. It's called The Quest for the Historical Jesus, and it was by a guy named Albert Schweitzer, famous medical missionary, Renaissance man, could play the organ, piano. I mean, he's just an amazing guy. He was responding, when he wrote that book, to all these sort of liberal Protestant thinkers that were sort of remaking Jesus in their own image. And Schweitzer sort of said, look, Jesus isn't that. He's just this apocalyptic figure that just doesn't fit like that. You just can't put him into some little bourgeois German story. And I'll never forget these words in that book. Schweitzer says, Jesus of Nazareth will not suffer himself to be modernized as an historical figure. He refuses to be detached from his own time. He will no longer be a Jesus Christ to whom the religion of the present can ascribe its own thought and ideas. Nor will he be a figure which can be made by a popular historical treatment as sympathetic and universally intelligible to the multitude. The historical Jesus will be a stranger and an enigma to our time. He comes to us as one unknown, without a name, as of old by the lakeside. He comes to those men who know him not. He commands. And to those who obey him, whether they be wise or simple, he will reveal himself in the toils, the conflicts, the sufferings which they shall pass through in his fellowship. And as an ineffable mystery, they shall learn in their own experience who he is. Now, Schweitzer was a person plagued by doubt and struggle. But when I read those words, I read them in some ways through the eyes of faith, because all of us in American culture have to grapple with Jesus. Right? And if you're here and you're someone that you're here because you're not sure quite where you'd put yourself religiously, like, I mean, the biggest growing religious demographic in the country is the nuns. And I don't mean like Gidget or whatever, like the flying nun. I mean like the flying nun, rather. Gidget's different than the flying nun, right? Sally Field played both, right? The flying nun. I mean people that aren't religiously affiliated. But even if you're not religiously affiliated, you have to grapple with Jesus. Right? There's kind of a Republican Jesus, a Democrat Jesus. There's a kind of conservative Jesus, a liberal Jesus. There's an affluent Jesus. There's a Jesus for the marginal. Right? All of us are drawn to this figure, and yet a little repulsed too. Right, because there's something in Jesus that C.S. Lewis says this about Aslan. It's great if you're a fan of the Narnia series. Is he safe? He says, no, Aslan's not safe, but he is good. No better words, I think, could be spoken of Jesus. He's such a compelling figure, and yet he's not safe, but he is good. And so, I think that sort of if you get, as a Christian, if you get Jesus, like, you could study the Bible your whole life. The older I get, the more important Deuteronomy 29:29 is to me. The secret things belong to the Lord your God, but the promises revealed belong to you and your children forever. Like, I take that as, like, if I was writing my own version of the message, it'd be something like, you're on a need-to-know basis and just a lot of stuff you don't need to know. So there's just a lot of stuff in the Bible, like, when you look at the Canaanites and all the, and what's the timeline on the flood and all these things. Like, I think that, like, there are certain doubts like that you can live with and hold in tension if you get Jesus, if you trust Jesus. There are certain things in the scriptures, because we're finite, that you'll never, well, all of us, they'll look a little different for all of us, but there are certain things we'll just never get. But if you can trust Jesus, that's okay. But if you don't get Jesus, you can have the best theology in the world. You can have the best grasp of historical critical studies. You can have read every book on the ancient Mediterranean, right? And you'll be plagued. You'll be plagued. But if you get Jesus and you can submit to him, as Schweitzer said, if you can hear the commands and respond to them in the obedience of faith, things clear up. Let me say one last thing before we get into our text, which is long, and I promise that I'll hope that the sermon won't correspond to the length of the text. But we're looking at John up through Easter, and only the second chunk of John, largely because John's story is pretty interesting, because John, all the Gospels are a little different, okay? Now, some people, like, if you see, like, Bart Ehrman, some of you, like, are, like, New York Times sort of readers or whatever, New York Times book reviews or TED Talk kind of people. Like, you might have seen Bart Ehrman interviewed, and he's a guy that will say, well, the Gospels are different, so this means you can't have any faith, things like that. I think that the form of God's revelation tells us almost as much as the content, right? So if God were not triune, and if you could know the Son without the Father, and the Father without the Spirit, and the Spirit without the Son and the Father, then we'd only expect to maybe have one story of Jesus. Like, if we're Islamic, that would make more sense, right? You have one prophet, one revelation. But if God is fundamentally relational, then it makes sense that we have four pictures of Jesus. And you need to hold them all together. And their details, you don't need to play them against one another. But you can see a richness to them, right? And one of the things that I think where John is so relevant, John's story is a little different. And where John's story is different is he focuses a lot on Jerusalem. Jesus takes all these multiple visits to Jerusalem that the other gospel writers don't tell us. Why I think that is, and this I got from the current pope who wrote, if you're looking for a good little book, I wouldn't endorse everything in it, but the best thing I've ever read on the Gospels is the current pope's book, Jesus of Nazareth. And his treatment of, like, why the Gospels are different and stuff like that, it's just brilliant, and it's very readable. But he thinks, actually, that James and John were sons of a priest. So what happened is the priest would, like, work a shift at the temple, right? And then they'd have another job, like, just a year. And you could be a fisherman. You could have a fishing business. It makes sense of a story we'll read about later where John, the disciple whom Jesus loved, goes into the temple, and it says they knew him, so they let him in the temple, right? He was familiar. And so the reason I think that John's story is a little different is because it's a gospel against religion. It's just a gospel against the worst forms of religiosity. And so it's almost like a gospel that repeatedly has Jesus in showdowns with the religious elites. And so I think most of us, like, again, most of us are drawn to Jesus somehow, but a lot of us, institutional religion, oh my gosh, there's no fiercer critic of institutional religion than Holy Scripture. It's such a revolutionary thing, right, that it's got this built-in internal critique to the worst forms. So when people say, well, you're part of the church, I mean, the church is the worst, I'm like, you're absolutely right. That's why Jesus died for us, because we're a mess. But Augustine said, and it said it really well, the church is a whore, but she's still my mother. And the one for whom Christ bled. And so it's this great gospel that it's a showdown. And we're going to, like, this is sort of, the last chapters, the last half, is this long ride. It's like Clint Eastwood or something, and the Unforgiven riding into town. It's Jesus taking his last ride into Jerusalem. And that's the road we'll be on. The King's Road. The road which he describes as the road to glory. Let's pray. God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing and acceptable in your sight. You, O Lord, who are our rock and our redeemer. Amen. There's three things that jump out at me in this text as I read it. It's a long text, right? But the first thing I think that is just arresting is the pace of the king, right? The pace is weird, right? The way this story unfolds is weird. Second, I want us to think a little bit about the reactions to the king, and last, the end of the king. So if you're an outline kind of person, like, there you go. It's not terribly creative, but the first is the pace of the king. Why does Jesus go so slow? It's so interesting now in the ages of text message and read receipts, right? Like, you send someone a message, right, that's something important. I know you read it at 2 o'clock. Why didn't you respond till 2:17? What were you doing in those 16 minutes that you couldn't be responding to my message, right? I mean, haven't you done stuff like that? Send a message and, like, I wonder, what's more important than my message that's not being responded to right now, right? It's a narcissist in us all. Like, I'm... But in all seriousness, I mean, isn't it painful when you need someone and they don't come? I mean, so I think there's almost like nothing more painful relationally than when your back's against the wall, when you're in desperation, and someone that you know is close to you and no cares doesn't seem to react in the way that's important, in the way that would be sympathetic, empathetic, in the way that would alleviate some of the pain just to know that they took it seriously. I mean, that can be such a gift when someone comes alongside you, even if they can't do anything, but to just know that you became their priority, that they were able to free themselves from the tyranny of the urgent and respond to something that was really important, like your pain. There are I once heard Tim Keller, a pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church in New York, say that there are two reasons people lie, right? One reason, all of us lie, right? All of us shade the truth. We all do it. He said one group of people, like me, are people that lie because they fear that they won't be accepted. Hey, Scott, did you call those two people on the list to sign up for this? Oh, I haven't even thought of it. But at that moment, right, what I forget is that Jesus is Lord, and that your rejection doesn't determine my identity, right? So that's one group of liars. Like, I want to be like, okay, all eyes closed, all heads bowed, raise if you're that kind of a liar, you know. And then the person always like, and you know, you were always the person that was like, you know. The other group of liars are people that lie because they don't want to be inconvenienced. Can you help me move Sunday? Oh gosh, or I'm moving Sunday, right? I have a root canal, or I say, do it on Sunday. Well, yeah, my dentist is special like that. It keeps over, you know, like. And that's another form of unbelief, a rejection that Jesus both died to free us from something, from the tyranny of not being accepted in the bondage of our sin, and for something, for communion and love. And so it's two twin forms of rejection. I think that, like, when somebody doesn't respond the way we want, we have this nagging fear that they're the second kind of liar. Right, that they really were not really important to them. And then it leads to the first kind of fear of self-acceptance, right? Like, what's wrong with me if they wouldn't, you know, gosh, I'm not important. Not only am I in pain, but I'm not important. I'd want to suggest that Jesus here his delays, what's clear in the story as it unfolds, as that he's the Lord. Okay? He's omniscient in this text, right? He seems to know everything. Right? There's no jeopardy category that's going to intimidate him in this story, right? And yet he delays. How, if he knows everything, and if he's loving and good, maybe not safe, but good, he doesn't come off like a bad guy in this story, why does he wait? I think his delays tell us two things about divine delay, which we'll all experience. Okay, because we're all finite, because we can't see the big picture, everything, oftentimes God's timing will just seem infuriating to us and frustrating. Oftentimes. Because we don't have, like, it's the need to know kind of thing, and it's so frustrating we're told you don't need to know. But sometimes we just don't. The other thing that's tough, too, I think, is even if we knew the timetable, because we're not just finite, we're fallen, like, we're not just, like fragile, We're also, like, we're whacked, right? The Bible says we're sinful. Like, there's just something about us. Like, we're not, C.S. Lewis says, we're not sinners because we sin, right? Oh, you just broke the law. Age six, you became a sinner. No, we sin because we're sinners. Because somehow we're all bound up in this tragic story where we've been victimized and we victimize other people, and we're all bound up with it. So, and it affects our desires, our emotions, affects everything. Well, it doesn't mean we're as bad as we could be, by God's grace, right? It's not like Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome all the time in the world. But it does mean that there's no part of us that are just not touched by the dark nature of sin. And so even if you did know the timing, you'd be like, that's not the timing I want. Imagine if God gave us everything we asked for. Like, I remember, when I got my first six guns, like, as a kid, I liked guns like every little kid does. I mean, at least every little boy likes guns. And I don't like them now as much, but I used to love them. And I remember, like, saying, I want to be a cowboy when I grow up. Well, when I was 18, my parents didn't go, we didn't save for college. You said rodeo college, you know? You're going to rodeo college. You said you wanted to be a cowboy, right? Here it is, 1981. You said it. I mean, so imagine if every time, I mean, it's because we're finite, we don't know everything, and because we're fallen, and we have, like, immature and sometimes selfish desires, imagine if God didn't delay. Imagine if things happened in such a way on our timeline. It's hard, and especially, and I don't mean to say this callously, and if this sounds insensitive, I don't mean to, I mean, don't hear it that way, or at least try not to, because some of you are frustrated right now, because you're in pain, and you're crying out how long, and it seems like there are no answers, but I want to suggest, as hard as it is, the alternative is worse. The alternative is worse. Because see, even though we don't know the exact nature of God's, like, showing up, we don't get, like, the access to God's iCal or Outlook if God's a Microsoft user. But we don't get access to it. But we can trust that God will ultimately answer in a time that's perfect. Not from our perspective. But it's just the nature of trust that we have to have. So the pace is exceedingly slow. I want to look quickly at the reactions to the king. Because I think, you know, like, some of you are connoisseurs of stuff. Some of you maybe are, like, connoisseurs of, like, really good coffee or fine wine or classical music or classic cars or something, right? And you know that, like, so maybe, like, you brew this, like, perfect cup of coffee and somebody, like, gives to you and, like, ah, this is awful. It's too strong. I just like McDonald's coffee or something, right? And immediately you think, that doesn't say much about the coffee because you know that's amazing coffee. It says more about the taste buds of the consumer of it, right? When you really know something's beautiful and excellent and somebody has a dismissive, it has some kind of reaction, it's almost as though their judgments judge them. That their insights about the thing really reflect sort of something deep about them, because this beautiful thing, they don't judge it, it judges them. That's Jesus on every page of the Gospels. Karl Barth says, and it was in our catechism today, that the story of the Gospels, if you had to, like, tweet the storyline, one way to tweet it would be, he doesn't say tweet it, but one way would be to say that the Gospels are the story of the judge judged in our place. He says, you know, what gets Adam and Eve in trouble? They want to be the judge. They want to know. They want to decide when they get knowledge of good and evil. They want to decide what true wisdom is. They want to decide how to use things in the garden, right? They want to be the judge. Every one of us wants to be the judge, right? It's all about self-exaltation. What do you do when you judge somebody? It makes you feel better about yourself, right? For a moment. The tragedy of it, though, is then you say, like, oh my gosh, I'm such a better friend than that person is. Then you say, am I really a good friend? It's the tyranny of the law, right? It's good for a second because you exalt yourself over somebody, but then it starts killing you because the judgment will eventually fall back on you. But that's the tragic nature of sin. We all are wanting to judge what's fitting, what's good, what's true. But what's clear about Jesus, he's the only one in human history that really is the judge. He's the only one that's allowed to say, I'll tell you when I'm going to heal. I'll tell you when I'm going to pardon. I'll tell you when the waves are going to come and go. He is the judge. And what's amazing is, he's judged in our place. He's the judge. And so the reactions tell us a lot. The reactions tell us a lot. And they reveal a few things about the nature of Jesus, which relates to the trust and the pace of the story. Two key reactions, I think, are Martha and Mary. Right? Both of them are questioning. But disciples. Right? They're questioning disciples. They're people that are not questioning out of a kind of caustic or like angry skepticism. They're not jeering, right? They're not mocking. But they really don't understand. They're in the position. What's great is they're pretty sympathetic characters, right? They're in the position all of us are in some point or another, in the midst of tragedy and pain. God, if you were here. What's interesting is what Jesus does with Martha. Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha said to him, "I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he dies, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Do you believe this? Mary, it's interesting, Martha, right? Jesus knows the nature of her struggle is somehow theological, right? He knows that in the midst of pain, she needs the truth, right? She needs, and she believes the truth on one level, right? She's saying, look, I'm not like the Sadducees, right? You know, there's like different parties of Jews. Ashley Warren told me this. The Sadducees were a group that didn't believe in the resurrection at the last day. They didn't believe in the afterlife, and that's why they were sad, you see. I thought that was great. I didn't grow up in like a real churchy kind of culture, and so like I always think these things are great. Like, I love these things. I'm like, that's so witty. She's saying, look, I'm not one of these people that deny the hope and restoration at the last day. I'm a good Jew. I think God's going to put things to rights in creation. At the last day, Jesus says, I'm the truth. The truth's not a proposition, it's a person. I am the resurrection of life. That's what she needed to hear. She needed the truth. Now, what does he do with Mary? Say, Martha, go tell her that theological lesson I just gave you. Like, I've got a busy timetable to keep. No, it's so interesting. Now, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, where have you laid him? They said to him, Lord, come and see. Jesus wept. Why doesn't he give Mary the truth? All she gets is tears. See, there are two struggling disciples, and Jesus knows who needs the truth and who needs the tears. Right? And they're both, their source is both Jesus. A lot of times, if you grew up in a more stereotypical sort of evangelical or conservative church, like, we're conservative, we're big on the truth, Jesus, right? Big on the truth, Jesus. Not always best at the ministry of tears. Likewise, a lot of my liberal Protestant friends, right? Some of you come from that kind of background, right? Love the tears, Jesus. Love the tears, Jesus. Love the compassion, Jesus. The truth, Jesus, that offends people. You know, we don't want to make you cry more. And what I think is, like, none of us will ever figure out Jesus, right? Because he's, even though he's incarnate, he's both fully God and fully human. And so it's always a mystery when he draws near. It's always a mystery. And that's okay to admit that you have problems. Like, you can say, yeah, I do struggle with that. Like, in a post-sort of enlightenment culture, right, like, that we're relativistic and tolerant and plural, you know, pluralistic, we love the John 8 Jesus. Love the John 8 Jesus, right? Love talking about the John 8 Jesus at work or at school. Woman caught in adultery Jesus, right? Non-judgmental, non-legalistic, anti-institutional religion. That Jesus sells. John 14, 6, I'm the way, the truth, and life. Now, in most of the world, the traditional societies, they have no problem with John 14, 6, because they don't have sort of the relativistic post-enlightenment bent we have. Their struggle is, how could Jesus be so soft on adultery when family is so key? And when marriages are violated, isn't this just too permissive? See, it's not a problem to have struggles, to have problems with Jesus. The problem is if you think your problems with Jesus are Jesus' real problems. It's interesting that if you're like a Da Vinci Code fan or like those conspiracy theory sort of movies, like the way they narrate church history is that there's all these imaginary heretics that are free thinkers, right? And then the Orthodox people come in and say, no. Like, we've got to wall this up. First off, I mean, Dan Brown has no pastoral experience, and I know that. Historically, but just intuitively, because he wants to convince us that for 300 years in the church they were doing everything one way, just saying Jesus was human and a great prophet, and all of a sudden the pastor came and said, we're making a big change, Jesus is divine now. Now, even then, I'm sure the number one rule in the church is, we've never done it that way. Right? And the second is likened unto it. We always do it this way. So, I mean, if that was possible, the great pastoral lessons at Nicaea or something. Now, I mean, what happens is, the Orthodox are always the people that are saying both end. The people that are defending against heresy are always people that are saying, it doesn't have to be human or divine. It doesn't have to be one or three. They're always saying, look, I don't know exactly what this means, but I know that if we try to square the circle, like, if you know, we got those, when you're a kid and like you just hit long division, you're like, remainders, are they good or bad? Did I do it bad because there's a remainder? Like, there'll always be some mysterious remainder, but if we don't keep that remainder, like, we'll get something simpler and easier to digest that will be less true. That it's better to keep two truths that are a mystery and both true than to get rid of one of them for simplicity. And so what we see is a Jesus here that you've got to be willing to grapple with the whole Jesus. And that's what the romance of Orthodoxy in the history of the church, it doesn't sound romantic and it makes you sound like a theological nerd, but the romance of it is people always saying, like, we just can't cut off this part of the story. It's too important. And it might make it harder to tell, but that's just who he is. Now, the last reaction I think that's interesting, and it's my favorite, is Thomas's. So Thomas called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, let us also go that we may die with him. Now, what's great about this is, like, there's not, like, tone in the Greek, right? So I already figured it out. Like, I don't know how he's saying that. And I think John is probably deliberate about that. Is he saying, all right, let's go that we can die with? I mean, they don't really get that. See, for John, the cross is going to be Jesus' greatest glorification. That's really clear on the page. But the disciples don't get that, right? So maybe he's saying it like, I want to get behind Jesus. But if he's saying it, he's saying it like with zeal without a lot of knowledge. Or maybe he's saying, well, let's go die with him then, all right, Jesus? Genius. It's like when Dick first discovered that sign up genius, I thought it was like, sign up genius. Like, no, I mean, oh, it's sign up genius. So it's almost like, I wonder if Thomas is saying, oh, yeah, let's go die too. Great plan. Like, But both, you could still be a disciple and say both. You can be a cynical disciple that says, well, let's go. Here we go again with Jesus. Dying to live. All right. Or it could be, let's go. I don't know where we're going, but if Jesus is there, yeah. It's the mark of the disciple. In the beginning of John, one of my favorite parts of John's gospel, in the beginning, it's a part we won't look at, but the disciples, Jesus says, the disciples go to Jesus, or he looks at the disciples and he says, what are you seeking? And how do they respond? Where are you staying? It's so weird when people, like, when you go to the Gap or something and the salesperson, and you say to them, how are you doing? And they say, how can I help you? That's so weird. I hate that, right? You're like, I just asked you a question and you responded with a question. It wasn't even relational. Like, it's so strange. But this is one of the rare instances where it's actually fitting. They're saying, what we seek is you. So we need to know your address. Later in John 6, when Jesus says, all right, here's the plan for discipleship. Cannibalism. Eat my body, drink my blood. Who's in? You ever see the movie Gandhi? They're on the top of a train with Lancelot Andrews and Gandhi are riding together. And one of the Indians, the untouchables on the top of the train, is like, oh, Christian. My neighbor is Christian. She drinks blood. Like, every week, blood of Christ. It's great. It's a great line. But when Jesus drops the cannibalism plan of discipleship, the numbers drop. Right? Like, that should be like the headings, like in the NIV study Bible or whatever. It should say, like, ways to reduce your megachurch. Like, you know, give Eucharistic theology or something, right? The disciples say, he looks at the disciples and says, what about you guys? And it's great. It's also, you don't know what the tone is. Where else would we go? Is it, where else would we go? I mean, you took us out of, we're in the middle. You know, we've left everything. Where are we gonna, what are we going to do? It's a long walk back. Or is it, where else could we go? We know this is true. Either could be the mark of the disciple, because you say it in the presence of Jesus. You say it in the presence of Jesus. Gregory of Nazianzus, ancient church father, said the unassumed is the unhealed. So that when Jesus became human, he entered into every part of our story. And so no part of the human condition is alien to the disciple. Some parts are really tough. Some of us have amazingly difficult and legitimate doubts and struggles. That doesn't kick you out of those. I mean, what's comforting about the Gospels, it's like the story of the worst Sunday school class ever, right? They never get it, and yet they're always disciples. They're always on the way. Lastly, really quick, I want to look at the end of the king. Now, normally, I remember in seminary, like, I think a lot of pastors use sometimes, including me, that sounds judgmental when I say it, but I've done this a lot too. Like, we sort of overuse like Greek and Hebrew sometimes, and sometimes it's honestly because we're insecure and we want to look like we know stuff. So I remember in seminary, this one somebody in a class on Matthew asked this guy Dale Allison, who is like one of the best Greek scholars like in America. He says, "What does it really mean in the Greek?" He says, "Exactly what it says in verse 13. That's why 26 of the best translators in the world rendered it that way." So I think that's a lot of time. Like, generally, the translations are pretty good. Like, it's rare that, like, it's something you can't trust. I mean, but once in a while, there's something that's a little strange. The way it says Jesus is deeply moved is so strange. Nobody translates it. In what I think, the Greek there is almost like an animal that's, like, charging. If your dog, like, gets anxious or you see a bull, like, going like this. I mean, kind of with these sort of, it's a frustration. Eugene Peterson puts it this way, and I think this is about as good as I've seen in the Message. When Jesus saw her sobbing and the Jews with her sobbing, a deep anger welled up within him. Later in 38, then Jesus, the anger again welling up within him, arrived at the tomb. It was a simple cave in the hillside with a slab of stone laid against it. The anger welling up again. Who's he angry at? Does he look angry with Martha and Mary? Does he look angry with Thomas? Does he look angry at the crowd? Have you ever seen someone you love that is in the throe of, like, despair? I don't just mean sad. I mean despair and dread. And it's no one's fault, and it's no one that you can identify. Maybe sometimes it is someone's fault that you can identify. Have you ever been angry for them? Calvin says Jesus here is like a wrestler ready to do battle. He's angry at death. He's angry at sin. He's angry at a rebellion that started thousands of years ago and that makes this place, this creation that's at some point so beautiful, so tragic and hard. He's angry because this is not the way it's supposed to be. In the eternal union and communion of the Trinity, this wasn't the plan. This was not what we were hoping to invite people into. You ever have a party that's so great that you just want to invite somebody because you're like, this is so good, I just want to expand the circle? Or have you ever had a party that you're like, I hope this person doesn't come because this moment's so good they're going to spoil it? In God, there's just not that defensiveness. And God's like, this communion and this union, this joy and this dance of love, we've got to open this up. And thus creation's born. But it wasn't meant to be a place that looked like this. Jesus is angry. That's why you can trust him. Now, most people would say that, I think a lot of people would say that the biggest challenge to faith, and I think it's a big one, is the problem of evil. Classically, it's called theodicy if you're like a theological nerd type person. But the problem would be like, how can God be both powerful, good, and loving, and there be sin and evil in the world? There be evil in the world. So usually what you do, like if you're sort of like, you want to write a like book to like solve this problem, which is, I mean, good luck. But like Rabbi Kushner, right? Why do bad things happen to good people? Now, if you're a sort of Orthodox Christian, you might say, we're the good people, right? I mean, like, but why? So Kushner says, well, God is just not that powerful. He's doing all he can, and that's why he's good and loving, but that's why there's evil. He just can't stop it. Some people will pull out the good and loving part. Well, God's just not that concerned about us. He's got a bigger plan, right? Some people will just say, we pull evil out. Sometimes in certain forms of Neoplatonism or Buddhism, Christian Science, right? Evil's just an illusion. It's not real. Yeah, tell it somebody's suffering. And Christians do it too, right? Oh, it's the Lord's will, right? As if what you're feeling is legitimized by saying somehow. Now, there's something about that, that's right. Like, of course, in God's ultimate mosaic of the story of your life, there are things that God allows in that can be overcome. But it's as if that this is like a divine directive. It's really minimizing the significance of evil. If Jesus is angry at this, and he's concerned and good, there's nobody more empathetic. And he's the Lord. But the Bible just doesn't give us a philosophical solution to the problem. It gives us a person. And that won't always answer all the questions of the heart of the philosopher, or the head of the philosopher, but it will speak to the heart. And we all have to suffer. Like unbelief and skepticism doesn't get you out of suffering. So why not suffer redemptively? Why not join as a disciple in the one that you know you can trust in the midst of it? Even if you have to cynically do it at first. If you're sitting here and you're on the fence, like, all right, I've come a few weeks, I don't worry. Try it. Even if you've got to do it with cynic, like, all right, let's go try this dying to life thing again. Try it. In conclusion, I want to read you one thing. I came across this sermon when I was in seminary years ago by this guy, Jim Dennison, and it's like, I wish I could, like, I thought about, like, how could I say this better than Dennison, and I just can't. So Dennison says, have you noticed this imitation of Lazarus in Jesus? Lazarus helpless, Jesus seemingly helpless. Lazarus passive, Jesus seemingly passive. Lazarus dominated by the grave, Jesus seemingly daunted by the grave. You see, Jesus is entering into the helplessness, the powerlessness, the passivity of Lazarus so that he can deliver Lazarus from helplessness, powerlessness, and passivity. Jesus is identifying with Lazarus so that Lazarus may be identified with Jesus. The transformation from death to life is a transformation which occurs in Jesus. The reversal from the grave to resurrection is a reversal which takes place Christocentrically. Jesus enters into the death that he may live. He appears helpless before the tomb that he may come forth from the tomb. He is passive under the curse that he may be raised up a blessing to those who love him, believe on him, have been transformed, yea, have undergone the death to life reversal in him. See, there's no healing without suffering. If you're going to live to love is to suffer. And to love perfectly is to suffer the most. This is the problem with prosperity theology, right? Oh, if you live a righteous life, God will bless. Jesus lived the most righteous life. He suffered all the time. But there's a difference between meaningless suffering and redemptive suffering. Why? Jesus says in John 9, that they ask who sinned, or this man or his parents, but this guy born blind, he heals. He says, neither him or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. So whose fault was this suffering? It's nobody's fault. But it's been allowed because something more beautiful than you could know without it is going to be brought through it. He says the same thing to the disciples in John 11. This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. Then he sort of spells it out later, right? Then Jesus told them plainly, Lazarus has died, and for your sake I'm glad. Those are such harsh words, unless he's the perfect king. You can't say that tritely. But the king that's not safe, but is eminently good and beautiful can say it. And for your sake I'm glad I wasn't there, so that you may believe. But let us go to him. This illness will not lead to death. But it did. Lazarus died. But see, he would be raised on the last day as all who trust and cling even in the most fragile faith of Jesus. Well, Paul says that we united in, with a death like his so we could share in a resurrection like his. See, Jesus trades places with Lazarus. He calls Lazarus in the tomb. That's where the religious leaders say, we've got to put him in the tomb. But Jesus wouldn't be in for 4 days. He wouldn't decay. This illness will not lead to death. It'll lead to the conquering of death. This illness will not lead to death. It's for the glory of God. This divorce will not lead to death. It's for the glory of God. The loss of this relationship will not lead to death. It's for the glory of God. The estrangement with your child right now or your parent will not lead to death. The sicknesses that either we're ill in minor ways or serious ways, or we know somebody that we care about, these illnesses will not lead in death. Will not lead to death. Because Jesus traded places with us. Because he calls us out of the tomb, goes into it and conquers death so that we can know and trust. And even as struggling disciples, even cynical ones, we can trust and follow him. Because he'll take us to the place of beauty, life, and glory. Amen.
We come to the communion table, and as Scott said, we have a Jesus who knows who needs a word of truth and who needs his tears. And he can do that because he's Lord. And his truth is sufficient because he's Lord, and his tears are sufficient because he is Lord. And so we come to the table, we come to communion, which his bread represents his body and the juice represents his blood. We come as an act of faith. In the midst of an uncertain world, it's this remembering act that centers us and reminds us week in, week out, in community, with one another, we profess that Jesus is Lord. And so I invite you this morning to come to the table. Stacy and I think Scott Newhouse will be serving. I invite you to rip off a piece of the bread, which represents his body, dip it into the juice, which represents his blood, and do it in remembrance of him. Because in this, we celebrate his death and his resurrection until he comes. Come to the table.